realize that this is a test, a kind of an initiation, and that if you are able to pass this test, you have stepped forward in the real development of your own humanity. So we have the emotions by means of which the body can be protected or persecuted. And then we proceed on to the mind, and here we really have a tricky fellow. The mind is a center of self-justification. The mind is forever telling us that we're right, whether we are or not. And the mind is also forever telling us that we're entitled to anything that we want, and this is also untrue. The mind tells us that we are living in a fun generation, but the mind is a liar because very few people are having any fun. We are told that we should have anything we want, but all we get out of this is an exaggeration of our desires. We want more. The more we get, the more we want, and when it comes to the final end of things, we leave it all behind. The mind has become a servant of our pleasures. It has found ways to contrive the justification of almost anything that we want. The mind tells us whatever we think we need, we need. And it also helps us constantly to build false pictures of our environments and our relationships with other people. The mind, therefore, is lazy. Very few minds really want to think. What they really want to do is to scheme. They want to jump at some conclusion. They want to back up an emotional attitude. They want to say to you or to themselves that the emotions say, I must have it. The mind says, well, then you probably better get it. And the result is emotion plus mind equals bankruptcy. All these things we have to take into consideration, yet the mind is not so bad. The mind also is an atom that can be split. It has tremendous energy potentials. In fact, we are wasting mental energy even more rapidly than any other kind. Because wherever we use a faculty or a function without training it, without giving it proper boundaries, without understanding what we're doing, we're working a hardship upon that faculty itself. So the mind today is behind our politics, behind our international intrigues, behind all these various colossal projects of mankind, which really mean nothing. The mind gives us a world which is little better than a castle in a sandbox. The mind as we use it today would have been appropriate to the requirements of the average 8-year-old child, but it's not equivalent to the needs of the moment. So the mind has to be given the time to cool off, quiet down, and be released also from the pressures of emotions or the constant nervous tensions of the body. The mind is a kind of a gentle creature, a teacher. It is the old sage, but it is also one of those conservative creatures that tries to justify anything we want. It is constantly catering to often the worst part of ourselves. Another thing that the mind can do is to substitute involved thinking for knowledge, which is not the same, they're not the same thing. The mind, for instance, has given a science, and science is a branch of learning that tells us everything except what we want to know. And here it falls down. And if we become really learned in science, we become a professor, we write textbooks on the subject, and we gain a good reputation. But when it's all said and done, we're almost in the same place that we were before. The values, the great lessons, the mysteries of existence, which are the primary subject of human need, are not there. Therefore, the individual becomes locked within a little intellectual universe made largely of his own thinking and intended largely for the gratification of his own instincts and attitudes. On one occasion, Mrs. Einstein visited one of the large observatories and looked at the magnificent telescope, and she asked them what it had been built for, and the attendant that was there said it was built in order that we might measure the boundaries of the universe. And Mrs. Einstein smiled and said, well, you know my husband did that on the back of an envelope. And to a certain degree, this is about the way it is. We are working with a tremendous mental world, and we're getting so fascinated by it that we think it is going to do us some good. But if it hasn't done it by now, it is not likely to do it in the near future. We are simply caught in a mental pattern. We justify our thoughts without understanding them. And we also continue to think of them and with them, although we have not considered the universe in which we live. It is assumed that the universe is whatever we want it to be. And if it isn't, it will be if we plan long enough and hard enough. But with the length and hardness of our planning, we come only to extinction. We cannot escape from the inevitables of the universal procedure. And every person with a philosophy of life has finally got to base it on universal truths. Nothing else will serve the purpose. Nothing else can help us to the degree that we need help. Then above the mind, we have certain other faculties which are a little dim, but which we do think a great deal of. One of them is the soul. And probably the soul is the most powerful atom that we know. It is said on some occasions or believed that the illumination of Buddha, when the universe opened and all the deities of all the worlds flowed down to form a vast galaxy of radiance that's extended from one end of space to the other, that this was the fission of a soul atom. In other words, illumination is this transcendence, the complete release of energy. And this energy, as spiritual or soul power, has a very large part to play in our lives, much more than we realize. We are not supposed to be sitting around waiting for this soul atom to be split. But we do have to recognize that the soul is an energy, and that this energy has a tendency to attempt to control the conduct of the individual to whom that particular soul is attached. The soul, therefore, is a moral force. It is conscience, perhaps, if you want to call it that. It is certainly a mysterious guardian angel. It is a power. The Greeks and Egyptians called it the daemon, not demon, but daemon, a spirit, an invisible thing, more powerful than any power that we know in this world. This soul power is the thing that reverses the motion of energy in our bodies. While we are functioning in the normal way, the soul is generally locked away by itself, with every effort being made to prevent any of its impulses from reaching our daily conduct. We do not want to be led by the soul today. We know that it will interfere with wealth, worldly position, and all the things that we regard as important. It may also warn us against alcohol and narcotics, or any other evil habit. But because of our attitudes, we do not want the soul to take the leadership. We want the soul to be very quiet, contribute nothing if possible, and remain inactive throughout life. Occasionally, however, we get a little twinge of need near the end and try to make some peace with this mysterious overpower in ourselves. But the soul as an energy can be of the greatest value, but it must function very quietly. If we put the mind to rest, not negative, but just calm, and let the emotions rest in peace, and let the physical body relax normally, and everything is quiet and peaceful, we may have the opportunity to hear or sense the presence of the soul, or what Emerson calls the over-self. Then we begin to get messages from the inside. Now, we get messages from the inside on other levels. I know people have gotten some horrible messages from the inside. We can be deceived and deceive others on the grounds that it came from inside ourselves. But the real fact of the matter was, it was merely a sublimation of wrong mental thinking, wrong emotional pressures, and wrong physical conditions. The negative mind, the self-centered emotions, can also radiate messages, but they are all tinctured by self-interest. They are all the result of egotism or ambition or worldly pressures. But if we are quiet and these pressures are not active, then the natural power of the soul and its energies can come forward to become a vitalizing force in our daily life. If the soul is able to lead the rest, the individual is practically safe. He will then grow as he was intended to grow, with the superior controlling the inferior on every level. The body must be controlled by the energy fields. The energy fields must be controlled by the emotions. The emotions must be controlled by the mind. And in due course, the mind must be controlled by the soul. When the superior in each case leads the rest, we have the proper government. We have a true commonwealth. We have no longer a despotism. We have the proper regard so that each part of our compound nature is duly and properly protected and given the resources necessary for its proper function. Now, the soul power gives us a capacity for peace. The soul gives us that something which surpasseth understanding. It is that which in everything makes the individual indestructible. It is something that cannot be taken away by any actual circumstance of physical existence. All motions, all thoughts, all physical conditions are relaxed into a normalcy in which the individual is not frustrated, not inhibited in any way, but is completely relaxed to reality. If he can gain this attitude, he will then have the energy fields of his body in the best possible relationship. Mesmer and several of those who worked with magnetism were quite convinced of the reality of a magnetic factor in the human being. This magnetic factor worked upon an energy field which was natural to the person. Every individual living thing, from even a tiny little pebble up to the vast galaxy itself, everything has an energy field. This energy field bears witness to the radiance of the gradual release of atomic energy. This energy field is the atom in ourselves acting as a motive power for all else. This was probably the idea behind the legend of the Atlantean energy called Vril. Vril was an energy which was internally created, depended on no fuel, depended on no machine. But without fuel, it could move and activate anything. It could create motion, but it was never, in a sense, supplied by any power outside of itself. Maybe something in the field of perpetual motion could come under the same heading. But anyway, this emotional or vital field of energy, which Mesmer referred to, he said very simply that as long as this radiant field of energy was protected, the individual would have good health. All sickness was an obstruction to the flow of life force. For the moment there was interference with the proper distribution of energy, sickness began. And if this force was deflected long enough, the area that was deprived would die. And as a result of the death of a small area, the rest of the body would be infected and ultimately perish also. So that this energy field was something that had to be protected, and all sickness was interruption in the flow of energy. Now also, in our larger life, our unhappiness is an interruption in the flow of life energy. Thoughtlessness causes it sometimes. Stubbornness, anything that is a frustrating force, inhibits energy. Opinionism, set to the point that the individual is unable to escape from his own fixed attitudes. This in itself is an obstruction to energy, and the opinionated person will ultimately perish from his own opinions. Everywhere, obstruction of any kind is the cause of tragedy. So the individual must prepare two things. He may have to prepare to live in an age in which nuclear fission becomes a major factor in his life. He may be under those conditions afflicted by the dangers of this form of energy. He must also, however, having this problem on his hands and living perhaps always in the shadow of a possible catastrophe, he must work on himself. He must fit himself to enter into an age of uncertainties and yet at the same time be completely certain of his own inner life. He must be able to carry on without fear or anxiety, even though conditions become increasingly perilous. His greatest protection is this ability to control his own hysterias, his own emotions, and his own fears. There is an interesting legend of an ancient city of the East in which a wise man went forth from the city to talk with the spirit of the plague. And the spirit of the plague was a great, powerful being, but in this particular case, basically a person of integrity, because plagues are not the result of some evil force on the outside. Plagues come from the people who suffer from them. But in any event, in this particular case, the wise man asked the plague to do a great favor. He said, when you go through this city, don't take everyone. Take only one out of 100. Therefore, maybe take 100 altogether out of the city and spare the rest. And the plague said, that seems to me to be a very reasonable request. And by Allah, I will do it. I will take only one in 100. And the others shall live. So the plague went through the city and everyone died. And the wise man went out afterwards and said, why did you break your word? And Plague said, I didn't. I only took one in 100. The other 99 in every 100 died of fright. Now this is an old story, but it has certain advantages. In a time of anxieties, let us be careful not to die of the anxieties instead of realizing that there are many ways we can survive unfortunate or unpleasant inconveniences. The problem we have always is that if the inner life is serene, we have a greater possibility of achieving the securities that we need. I knew a nurse at one time who worked for a number of years in a leper colony and never had the ailment. And so I said to her after she had retired and gone home, I said, what do you feel was the reason why you never had the ailment? She's always very simple. I've let it be known to God that I was doing the best job I could for him and that whatever he wanted, I will have it. If he wants me to have leprosy, I'll get it. If he doesn't want me to, I won't get it. But regardless of anything, I will serve him. And with this attitude, she didn't get it. Whereas others, around the same colony, did get it. The tremendous integrity behind the dedication is important. And in the time of these nuclear researches, there is something to be said for the power of the individual to survive by the very intensity of his own inner life, a life that simply does not take on the overtones of anxiety, which are more likely to kill than anything else. In the Great Plague of London in the 17th century, death was on every street. There was not really any way of burying the dead. And one individual who had the plague became so hysterical and so overcome with fear that he rushed screaming through the streets of London and jumped into the Thames. When he hit the water, he got well. The guy came out and recovered. And they asked him why it happened? Well, he said, I really don't know, but I think it's because I became more afraid of drowning than I was of the plague. So, many times, problems of all levels, mental, emotional, physical, are more or less basically imaginary, are dramatized by our own reactions, and we die of these dramatizations. There are a great many cases where miraculous things have happened as a result of the tremendous intensification of a constructive attitude. I think this has probably been true of most of the shrines of healing, as Lourdes in France. Everyone isn't healed, but certain persons who have a tremendous faith in things, a faith greater than fear, reminds us of the story of the plague. It is fear that becomes the most deadly and desperate emotion in life. It not only affects our physical health, but affects our relationships with society. It affects our voting at the polls. It affects our jobs. It has a very definite destructive effect upon family life. It destroys relationships between parents and children. Everywhere, from the banking system up and down, fear leads to panic, and panic leads to destruction. So that inside of ourselves, when calamities or misfortunes begin to worry us, we must recognize the importance of not fearing. Now, in ancient times, and to a great degree still among many people, faith becomes the antidote for fear. The individual has some internal conviction about a power superior to himself. He becomes aware that he has a belief, a faith, that perhaps represents the soul dimension within himself. However it is figured, it is a power to trust realities. And when faith takes the place of fear, miracles happen. Miracles of healing happen. Miracles of adjustment to society. Everywhere, faith becomes a power, even in the problem of nuclear fission. Because faith is another very important energy. The ancients realized, for some reason that we've never been able to fully understand, that all these feelings, emotions, attitudes, beliefs, and convictions are beings, not merely thoughts in the mind. Therefore, they created deities out of all their emotions and attitudes. And these deities became more or less independent beings that were capable of being requested or invoked for help. And by this means, all these positive, constructive factors became gods or goddesses, and all the destructive attitudes became demons. And wherever destructive attitudes took over, plagues followed of one kind or another. But where constructive attitudes dominated, things cleared up. And the credit was given to the deity. But the deity, of course, was really part of the soul atom. It was part of the tremendous power in the soul to become the redeemer. Because the soul atom, or energy, being the highest, was able to control the rest if it was properly used. If it was properly understood, properly recognized, and the individual called upon it in his hour of trouble. Therefore, religion becomes, again, another great nuclear entity. It becomes a tremendous vital force. And in our case, the splitting of the religious atom has caused the same kind of tragedy that we fear from the physical atom. The moment religion was broken up into a mass of creeds, its constructive value was largely decimated. For a long time, this destructiveness was not especially noticeable because religions were local. They belonged to races and nations and cities. But when world power began to develop, And religions began to be part of a great world picture, the conflicts between them became very dangerous to the survival of the human being. If we split the religious atom, so to say, and recognize or believe that religion is a mass of different realities, we are in trouble, for there is only one reality. And the reality in this case, the tremendous energy of the union of religious parts into one tremendous totality, we call God. This is the infinite energy that rules and governs all things. If we break it up and say, my God and your God, we are in difficulties. Wherever we break up, we are in trouble. What we must try to do is to grow up to the totality of it. We must try in one way or another to put together the parts of ourselves. We cannot say this is the right leg and this is the left. We have to recognize that they are equally important and are both part of one body. All division is within bodies, but the body as a principle is never divided. All religions exist within one religion, and that one religion is never divided. All of the divisions, all of the separations, all of the conflicts and confusions are due to that little thing we call the mind, that this atom has taken over. So in Zen, we go back again to this same point, that by being calm and quiet, by being dedicated, we gradually discipline ourselves away from the causes of our troubles. In Zen, for example, we escape the pressure of worldliness. We are not any longer ambitious for public office. We are not ambitious for wealth. We are not ambitious for recognitions. We are not self-centered or vain. We live, in a sense, as naturally as possible, and all the energies that we have are devoted to services and good works. We try to use the power we have as it should be, for the greater good of the greater number. The life in us is dedicated to the needs of others, because all we can do for them also is to help them to release the life that is within themselves. So the great atom is in all of us. A most tremendous and wonderful experience comes through the gradual recognition of the tremendous integrity that is locked within each of us. It is behind the criminal, it is behind the person who is today without morality. It is behind the rich and the poor, the great and the humble. And in all cases, it is this tremendous blazing star or spark, which is life, which brings us into a partnership with all that lives. For regardless of our race or our estate, the spark in us is the same. In some cases, the energy of this spark has been more developed than in others. Some have given greater areas for its manifestation. Some have, for instance, taken on learning in order that that flame in us might shine brightly in some branch of human society. But whatever we do, whether we settle down to being a good carpenter, or whether we try to become a priest or become an educator, only thing we are really doing is releasing a part of this energy atom in ourselves. We are releasing it into manifestation. We are empowering a virtue. Now, we might have been very willing and desirous of empowering it before, but we had not trained the instrument for its manifestation. Whatever we want to do to release this power from within ourselves, we have to have something to offer. In this old story of the tabernacle in the wilderness, the offerings were brought to the altar of the temple or the tabernacle. Each brought a gift offering. Each brought something. And the most acceptable offering, of course, was the animal nature of the individual himself. There were labors of purification where the individual gradually overcame his own selfishness and all these physical limitations. And at last, purified of all dross, he was permitted to enter into the holy place. But this is, of course, just exactly the way it is in life. We have to bring our offerings to this energy. The individual says, I want to do something, but I don't know what to do. Well, that the idea is good, but the motivations are inadequate. An individual says, I want to do good. I think people should have better homes. I'll help them build them. So I'll study carpentry. And when we become a good carpenter, then that ray of our inner soul atom vitalizes that ability, and we become servants of truth. For always we are serving the atom that is truth, and the tremendous energy center, the great spiritual atom, which we call the universe, is always dedicated to good, and that which serves good gains universal citizenship. While we are tied up in our own little personal belongings and beliefs and feelings, we are private citizens. But when we begin to serve the larger causes, we are citizens of the world. And with this energy factor developing as it is, we probably will have to become aware every day of the application of certain symbolism to the new forces, new energies, new resources that we are developing. But with all of it, we have to realize that we are never able to get away from the divine purpose. No matter what we learn, no matter how much we know, or how strong we become, all rests finally with the integrities which are established in nature. When we keep the rules, we are wise and good. And as we keep the rules, we discover that doing the things that are necessary are the greatest joy, and all other things become secondary. This is again a way in which we approach the problem of Zen. For in Zen quietude and self-discipline, we have reached that condition in which we permit no attitude to interfere with realities. Now, this sounds as though it might be frustrating, but it is not, because the realities are more beautiful, more wonderful, and more valuable than any false interpretation we can place upon them. It is tremendously important, above all things, to have inner peace. And until the world has inner peace, the struggles of humanity will never cease. We will never be able to fulfill our proper destiny until the inner life is at rest, because it is firmly established in truths that are eternal. Until we have these firm establishments, all of our outer affairs cannot be properly brought into proper relationships. So out of all this study of atoms and so forth, we are probably going to develop a new philosophy, a philosophy of the realization that the potential of the human being is infinite, that the unfoldment of life is eternal, that all that is necessary is always available. But between that which is available and that which we use is the barrier of our own ignorance. Therefore, we should be spending as much time as we can preparing ourselves for a larger destiny than we have ever known. Not a destiny of honors and wealth and distinctions, but a destiny of inner realizations, the gradual and ultimate realization of our place in the divine plan of things. And we also will gradually come to know, as a result of this, that there is no easy quietude beyond. We're not going to do very much harp playing. We're not going to float around on flowery beds of ease, as stated in the old hymns. We are going to find that the further we go, the more we will come under the tyranny of infinite power. We will realize that we are constantly required to manifest the divine purpose. That wherever we are going to be working to protect the flow of this divine atom in ourselves. That we are going to find more and more ways of using it. We are also going to find that it is our ever-present help in time of trouble. Finally, this mysterious atom in ourselves becomes obviously the real self and contains within itself the possibility, the potential of every value existing in nature. That little spark of divine life in us locks within itself a cosmos as vast as any universe we can imagine. There is no end to the unfoldment of life, but all of this unfoldment is toward the final justification of existence, until someday in spite of the scientific opinions to the contrary, we are going to find that the universe is a happy place. That it is a place of fulfillments and not of frustrations. And that we are all privileged to grow along with each other toward this goal. And that when we understand this growth, the happiness begins with the understanding. We don't have to wait for the growing. Everything that we believe and want can be fulfilled. There can be nice homes. There can be happy children. There can be busy people doing interesting things. There can be self-expression, developments in arts and ethics. There can be all kinds of wonderful experiences as we go along. The moment we change the point of view and get away from this constant sense of separateness, which is the split atom, and realize actually that these separatenesses all fall together to make one, and that in the fullness of time, the fullness of realities, we can earn anything we want, anything we need. And that actually Zen tells us this. It says you can have anything you want for one very simple reason. You won't want anything. I think with those kind words, we better stop.